Welcome to Loud and Lifted. I'm your host, Betsy Hamm. Be assertive, but not aggressive. Speak up, but don't be too loud. Show confidence, but actually stay humble. You likely heard all this advice. It seems impossible to walk the fine line. And how do you be powerful and likable? We want to know how to be badasses, not bitches. I'm joined by Allison Fragale. She's an organizational psychologist and a professor who studies the science of status, aka how much we're respected and regarded by other people and why that matters so much for success and satisfaction. She breaks it down in the simplest way I've heard. People are constantly sizing us up on two things. Are you a friend or foe? Do you care? And can you deliver? Are you capable? That's the heart of being a likable badass. So we're going to dig into how women can build respect without trading away who they are, because we're not here to pick liked or taken seriously. We're here for both. So let's go. Welcome to Loud and Lifted, Allison. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I love nothing more than when you're scrolling on LinkedIn and title or platform name just kind of jumps out at you and grabs your attention. And you're like, oh, I need to learn more about this. And that's how I came across you and likable badass. Love that so much. So tell us a little bit about how did you come up with this and what exactly likable badass is all about?
Yeah. So the book and a lot of the work I do is about the science of status and what an important variable that is. Status is how much we're respected and regarded by other people. And so it's a judgment that other people make about us, but it's a judgment that is really important for our life satisfaction and our success. And likable badass is my catchy term for how people make decisions about how much status another person has, how much respect they have for that person. Everyone's always trying to evaluate two things. We care about these things and other people evaluate us on these two things. The first thing we want to figure out about another person is, are they friend or are they foe? Are they going to be helpful to us or are they going to hurt us or compete with us, make our lives difficult? And obviously, we prefer to be in relationships with people that we think, oh, this is going to be a helpful person. They are going to make my life better by being not just likable, but honest, sincere, giving, helpful. Those qualities make other people's lives better. Mm. And we value that. And then the second thing that we care about is beyond your intentions is your capability. Can you deliver? So it's nice that you want to help me, but are you actually able to help me? Because do you have the skills? Are you results oriented, competent, capable, persistent, decisive? So on the cover of the book, I use the terms likable and badass to talk about those two fundamental dimensions. Do you care and are you capable? And those two dimensions are how respect judgments get made. So what it means for us is every time we can show up in ways that send signals to our audience, hey, this person really cares and they're really good at what they do, then what will happen in the other person's brain is they'll be like, oh my gosh, I really respect that person. I value that person. So that's really what I try to teach people is I break down the science, but then I help them think about how they show up so that they send the signals to the world, because all of this is perception. They send those signals that people can realize how caring and capable you truly are.
Oh, and I love that. It's such a balance. And I think back to early in my career where I wanted, started having people report to me, they were older than me. And it was like, you wanted them to like you, but then they also, you wanted them to respect you and understand that you were in a position of power. So it is a very interesting concept that I think, I'm assuming from the research, women probably struggle more with this than men.
They do, they can, which is why I chose to write the book for women, even though status is not a gendered concept, sure. Because a variety of things influence our status. A lot of things that we control about how we show up influence our status, but also some things that we don't control. And gender is one of those things. Mm-hmm. So that's where bias comes in. So all other things being equal, people will instantly ascribe more respect and status to a man than to a woman. Mm. So again, that is bias, and that's something that we have to overcome. It is very overcomable through the things that we can control, but that is why it can feel like more of a struggle for women, because it is more work. It is more of a struggle.
Sure. And what's the difference between power and status? Like, how do you define that?
So status is being respected and valued by other people. Power is controlling resources that have value to you and other people. So money is a resource.
Oh.
Being able to make decisions on your own, being able to give people rewards and punishments, hire them and fire them, give them good performance reviews or bad ones, buy their product or not. Like, these are forms of power. I even say, you know, as a parent of three kids, one of my kids drives a car. And so if I'm holding the car keys, I'm holding a resource that at that moment has value, but only to that kid, right?
Right.
So that would do nothing for my two that don't drive. But if I'm holding it, I have a resource that he wants. And what will happen? I will have more influence. He's much more likely to do what I say. And so why power is so valuable to us is it sets us up for influence. Status is different. Status is, again, being respected, but it also is a source of influence, because if we don't respect people, we'll never be influenced by them. But if we do respect them, we're much more likely to trust them and do what they say.
That's a great point. And I think people probably get that confused and try to use it interchangeably. And you think like, oh, you're a vice president, you're a director, you have power, you have status, and you may not have both or either.
Correct. So it's absolutely the case that you can have status on the basis of a job title or a credential. That simply knowing, people knowing that you hold this position, you hold this degree, their brain might say, oh, okay, I respect that. I respect that, you know, position. So that can happen. And so you could have both. But obviously, as you say, it's not a guarantee you're going to have both.
Right.
Just because you have power in a position or a title does not necessarily mean that people respect you. Everyone can think of somebody that has a lot of power and that no one respects. And
oh, so fast.
Right? Life is hard for those people. And right. So we want to understand both of these variables, because we deserve, particularly women, deserve to have both. It's not about having to trade one for the other. It's about how do you get yourself in a situation where you can have as much power and as much status as you want.
So how do you do that?
Well, I talk about in the book about focusing on status first and flipping the script. So many of us want to jump to the power, like promote me, pay me. I want you to be promoted. I want you to be paid. You deserve it. But the problem is, if you try to go after those things with an audience that doesn't value you, they're very unlikely to want to give you those things. So starting with status, I talk about, is really foundational and important. And the way we influence it is by thinking about how we show up in our environments, how we communicate, how we get in front of people, and in ways that are going to send signals to them. Hey, I really care and I'm really capable. And there's lots of different signals that we can send. Like, you know, in terms of caring, I talk about this in the book, like smiling is a signal. When someone smiles at you, you think, oh, their intentions are good, right? They like me. They're in a good mood. They're going to be fun to interact with. If someone's scowling or frowning, you might think, they don't like me. They're not a person I want to engage with. Complimenting somebody is, you know, a signal that you care. So, I mean, there's so many different signals. And then we have signals that about how capable we are. Maybe it is a credential that we have. Maybe it is a form of expertise. Maybe it is we are a fast talker. And when people ask questions, we can respond to them really quickly without hesitation. And people think, oh, you didn't even have to think about that for a second. You must really know what you're talking about. So the brain is picking up on all different kinds of things. And what I help people understand is, what does the brain pay attention to? And then what are your authentic signals that you really like to send, so that you're sending the signals that are going to get you rewarded and you're not unintentionally doing things that are sending the wrong message, which sometimes we do, including myself.
That's interesting. And, you know, we've spent so many past episodes where building your personal brand comes up, right? And what's your brand? What's your image? How do people describe you when you're not in the room? And I never really thought about that, how that influences or impacts the status piece, but that's all about being intentional of how you show up.
That's right. So brand is very related. I always say, if I were a marketing professor, I would talk about it as brand, but I'm a psychologist, so I talk about it as status. The idea is that the kinds of elements of brand that people generally want are ones that are associated with status, right? No one's saying like, I really want my brand to be difficult and hostile. Like no one puts that on their vision board, right? Your brand is people, the brands that people desire are going to be high status brands. Like, I want people to say some version that I care deeply about people other than myself and that I add value to the world. And the characteristics themselves might differ, You know, so I have, like, humorous is very much part of my brand. Not everyone would pick that, but with humor, right? Humor is a mark of intellect because it's hard to make people laugh. Mm. It's also a mark of caring, like that you're bringing a fun atmosphere and creating that. So you can have different brands that are authentic to you, but a good brand is going to be one that's going to hit in your own way on both of those dimensions, that it's going to signal to people, this is a person that really cares and this is a person that can deliver results.
Well, that's a good point about being authentic, essentially, right? So if being empathetic and caring doesn't come naturally, is that something that you can work on improving and be genuine about it?
I would say to people, if you don't actually care about anybody other than yourself, life's going to be pretty hard. But most people I encounter do care about people. Now, what they might not be is good at showing it. Mm-hmm. And that's where you just have to experiment a bit with what's your signals that you're going to send that are going to show the world how truthfully caring you actually are. And I think that's the real key is finding your signal. So I talk a lot in the book that I'm not a good smiler. I probably look okay right now, but when I see pictures of myself on stage speaking, as I often do, I have yet to find one usable action shot in over 20 years of being a speaker because I have the same growly look on my face every single time. Okay, I'm not a good smiler. You don't have to convince me that I am. I already understand that I'm not. That's okay. Smiling is a signal of warmth. Like scowling is not. So my natural nonverbal expression is not doing me any favors. Hmm. And that's okay. But if I'm aware of it, I really don't want people to think I'm unhappy with that because this is how my face is shaped. So I have to figure out my workaround.
Sure.
And so I think, what am I good at? I'm good at using my words to make people feel good, to compliment them, to help them, to celebrate them, those things. And so that's what I do. And so I do think that I have cultivated a brand as someone who is very warm, very approachable, very friendly, very caring, but I do not do it through my facial expressions. I have to do it in other ways. And that's the idea of you can go for the same outcome, but you can approach it your way. So what I will say to people when they're struggling with how to show empathy, warmth, caring is like, what is your favorite way to show people that you care about them? And then let's figure out ways you can lean into that more because that's going to feel good to you because it's really authentic. And it's going to be really effective.
Oh, I love that. That's so true. Some people are just more natural to the smiley, like laughy, whatever, very warm behavior. And there's, I know I have friends, coworkers who aren't, but it wasn't because they were any less. It's just how they portray that. So I love finding what makes sense for you, what's comfortable, right? When you're fake smiling and you're fake laughing, everybody sees through that. So
that's right.
Trying to really embrace what you're good at. So how do you balance, especially I think as women, because as I mentioned, I experienced this earlier in my career, I've seen other women struggle with this, where you want to be nice, you want people to think you're nice, but you don't want them to think you're a pushover and that you don't know what you're doing and like, oh yeah, she's nice, but she's not competent. So how do we build that other half of this?
This is where I think experimenting with forms of nice that also showcase competence, because the best thing is if you can show up as both at all times, then you're hitting all the bases, right? You're signaling that you're all the things. So there are some forms of being nice that showcase your confidence. There are competence. There are other forms of being nice that have no impact. And there are some that actually decrease your competence. So you have to think about this. So an example would be like, if I buy you a coffee, that's a nice thing to do. Mm-hmm. Doesn't showcase me as particularly competent, but it doesn't undermine my competence either, right? It's just a neutrally nice behavior. If I self-deprecate, if I say that I'm bad at something and I cut myself down, now that is also warm in the sense that it's humble, it's modest. It's sometimes self-deprecating can actually be funny. Comedians often do it. And so all of those things can increase your warmth, but those come at an expense. You're seen as less capable because you've just told people you're not good at stuff. So that could be a dangerous form of warmth. It's maybe worse than buying a coffee. But then better than buying a coffee would be something like making an introduction to somebody. If I introduce you to like a great podcast guest, you're like, you know who I would really like to have on my podcast, Allison? So-and-so, I think I can introduce you. You'd be like, oh my gosh, that's so nice. It's a warm behavior. It's really friendly, but wait, it also, more than buying a coffee, it allows me to show up as unique. Hmm. in the sense that I have a network, a relationship web that you don't have. So what I encourage people to think about is how to be cognizant of their behaviors and evaluate how they are, how much those behaviors showcase that other dimension. Hmm. So I try to help people go move away from behaviors that are at one at the other's expense. So if I am and kind of angry and hostile, I might, and like, I'm like really like very strict and stern, I might be able to like drive results and get people, but at the expense of being liked. And if I'm, you know, self-deprecating and cutting myself down, everyone likes me, but nobody thinks I can drive results.
Right.
So looking for ones that are going to hit on both, or for example, like if I'm buying someone's coffee, I'd say, okay, that's a nice thing to do. So in their brain, I've probably checked the box, like being nice, but I haven't checked the box yet of being capable. What could I say or do or talk about that they would also recognize me as being both of those things? So once you start to recognize that there are two dimensions, you can start to evaluate how you're showing up and saying, okay, if I'm showing up well on one dimension, but I haven't really done anything on the other one, what can I do to lean into it? Or if I have something like in my case, you're a bad smiler, you actually look unfriendly, you look angry, you have to compensate a little bit. What else could you do? So that's how you can start to think about it, because you are a multi-channel form of communication. You have lots of different signals you send, and you just want to be aware of what are they, so that what I'm sending to a person's brain is representing the full spectrum of all the value that I have.
No, that makes sense. And when you're at the other end of the spectrum, right? Like I'm saying, if you're too nice and you're too kind and you're not taken serious, then there's the other end. You know, I think when women are difficult or too intimidating or intense, so it's like, I don't know, is there a way to kind of pull that back, or is it still the same approach? You're just, hey, you're trying to get to the middle, right? You don't want to be at either end of the spectrum.
Okay, so this is one thing I want to say. People often think about these things as a single dimension. Mm-hmm. Like there's being assertive on one end and being nice on the other. But in the book I show, there are actually two dimensions, like an x-axis and a y-axis.
Okay.
So that's a really important mental shift, because if you think they're one dimension, you always think you're trading one off against the other. Hmm. But you don't, sometimes you might choose to be doing that, but you don't necessarily have to. So that's the first thing, is a lot of times people are given feedback that you're too, let's say too nice. And I would say that I understand where that feedback comes from. But let's break it down. Was that feedback meant to be intended to be literal? Meaning, what I actually would like from you is some more meanness, please. Could you be a little bit more unkind and cruel? No one's actually saying that. Even though their words are too nice, they're not saying, like, someone once said, like, should I stop saying please and thank you? I've been told I'm too nice. And the manager was like, that's a terrible idea. That's not what people want you to do. People don't want you to like slap something on their desk and be like, do it. But what they are trying to tell you something, and what they're trying to tell you normally, is you're not showing up strong enough on the other dimension.
Mm.
So when people say you're too nice, what they're saying is, I'm not seeing enough capability and results orientation out of you.
Mm.
And so I would say, don't pull back on being nice, but think about, I need to show you that I'm the other thing as well. And I can lean into how assertive, competent, capable, results oriented I am. Similar thing. If someone says, you're too assertive, you're too aggressive, you're too opinionated, you're too that, they're saying, I'm getting lots of assertiveness from you here. Like you're really excelling, but I'm not getting anything on the piece that you care. And so I would tell people, it's not about being less opinionated or less confident. It's what they're saying is they're not seeing anything on the other dimension. How do we show them that you really care? So I think the answer is, when you get the too much feedback, it is, the instinct is pull back. What I want to say is no. Amplify the other dimension. Mm. What they're telling you is, you've got that first dimension down cold. Check it off. You've got it. Amplify. Not, and I call it adding, not subtracting.
That is such great advice. And as you're saying that, not that I'm perfect, but I can think of people in my life, right, or that I worked with, and especially one that everybody would say was too nice. Oh, she's so nice. She's too nice. But that caused her to not be assertive, not to give her opinion, not provide feedback, you know, and sort of that catching every piece of advice she'd give was like, oh, I'm not sure. Or like, she just was so afraid to hurt other people's feelings, obviously lacked confidence. But you're right. It wasn't about her being too nice. It was just her getting more comfortable with giving feedback, saying no, having boundaries, you know, whatever it is. That's a really interesting way to look at it, which I never did. So thank you for that.
Of course.
So is there any myth that you love to bust about being too nice or being respected or anything along that, that you've learned through writing this and all the research?
Well, this is, I think, the main one we just covered, which is that it's an either or, right? And so many people try to approach it that way. And I say, no, no, no. You can be both. Lots of people are both. You have people that you respect like this. And to really lean into adding things into how you show up rather than subtracting. Because subtracting is, one, not only less effective, it also feels way less authentic. When you are told that you're too much of anything and then you have to feel like you have to hide it, that's called emotional labor. It takes work. It leads to burnout. It leads to resentment. And it makes you feel like you are not getting to be your true self. When you have to add something in, it feels a lot more authentic. So I really do think that this is the key myth that I spend a lot of time debunking, because it's such a natural tendency to take people at their word. You said I was too something, so I will be less of that thing. It sounds logical.
Right.
It's just when you play it out, you realize, wait, that's not exactly what they were trying to tell me. They just didn't have the words for it.
No, that makes sense. So when you think about certain difficult situations like negotiation, self-promotion, even difficult conversations, is there any language or any approaches that are helpful when we're trying to be that likable badass, but be in these challenging situations, whether, like I said, negotiation, self-promotion, difficult conversations, any advice on how to handle those?
Yeah, so I do talk a lot about self-promotion in the book and in general, because we are the most informed, motivated channel of communication about ourselves that exists. Mm-hmm. No one knows us better than us. No one cares about us more than us. So if we are not telling our story, how would people even know it? I mean, like, so many aspects of who I am, you would have no way of knowing unless I gave them to you. So we have to tell our story. That is self-promotion. But the way to self-promote well is to do it where it hits on both of these dimensions. Self-promotion is obviously a win on the like capability. If I tell you I'm great, then you're more likely to think I'm great. But it's a threat on the warmth, right? Are you going to like me? Maybe I'm not modest or humble. And so that's where the tension of self-promoting comes in, is I want to be both and I can't figure out how to self-promote and be warm. So there, I talk about a variety of research-based strategies, and you don't have to do all of them, but find something that makes you feel comfortable telling your own story. One of them is what's called dual promotion. I often refer to it as brag and thank, which is you say something good about yourself and then you offer thanks for someone else that played a role. Okay. I promote me and I promote you. Now, I am not self-deprecating. I am not saying, oh, no, I didn't do anything. It was all Betsy. That's self-deprecation. Dual promotion is I achieved this great outcome and special thanks go to following people who played a role. So let's say your podcast gets an award and you would say, I was really honored to get this award. And I want to thank these, like, the producers or the editors who helped me behind the scenes. I want to thank a lot of guests who have come onto my show, and you can name a few of them or whatever. When you do that, you're taking the credit, but then you're also giving credit to somebody else. And what the research shows is that when you take the credit, I did a good thing, you are seen as more capable. And when you give some credit to somebody else, you're also seen as more warm. So that's a good way to check a box. And it, that can be used in a lot of different things. You could use it on social media. You could use it in a weekly update email that you might send to your boss or other people at work. Hey, here's what's happened, you know, on our team this week. I'm just filling you in. Here's the wins, and special thanks go to people A, B, and C. You could use it in a meeting at the beginning where you celebrate something that's happened and thank people for the role that they played. So that's one example of how you can use science and bring it into your everyday behaviors and say, hey, every time there's something I want to shout from the rooftops that I did well, let me shout it and also give a shout out to someone else. And when I do that, I will be hitting on both of those important dimensions. With negotiation, for example, I have a whole chapter in the book on negotiations. There are other techniques you can use. So one specific one is giving people multiple options. Okay, so I'm a parent, I have three kids, and parenting, at least in today's day and age, is very much one of giving kids controlled choices. So I was born in the 70s. My dad was like, here's how you're going to do it. There will be no questions. That is what it is. But of course, I'm like, no, that's too strict. I want my kids to see how much I care about them and build these relationships. But I can't have the inmates run this prison, right? There has to be some control. So I'm going to give my kids a curated set of choices. Like, okay, which of the three very healthy dinner options would you like for dinners? You can pick, right? But you don't get to pick like pizza or burgers or ice cream. Like you can pick like the chicken or the fish or whatever. So when I do that, what am I trying to do? I am trying to show them that I care, because when you give people choices, their brain thinks is, oh, you must care about me because you're giving me some say. Hmm. But at the same time, I'm also being able to assert my own interests in this by saying the choices are confined to things that are good for me. So that's an example that we see evidence in the negotiation research is when we negotiate with people, and getting your kid to eat dinner is just as much a negotiation as like buying and selling products. When we negotiate with people, they're going to like us more. They're going to feel like we're more warm and caring when we give them choices, but we can also be assertive and drive our own outcomes. So rather than make one offer, the idea of making three simultaneous offers, like you can have these three different dinners, is a very specific negotiation technique that can be used by anyone, but particularly women, to say, hey, I'm going to show you how much I care by giving you these options, but I'm also not going to sacrifice myself in the process because the options are all good for me.
Right.
So those are techniques that I help people recognize where they can bring I care and I'm capable together rather than have to play one off against the other.
I like that because it has a little bit of control, right? Still involved is what it's what I think the basis of it is, but people feel like they have an opinion, they're valued. So that makes complete sense. What about with a difficult conversation? I think sometimes that's where people either go in way too hard or too soft. So how do we handle those difficult conversations?
The first thing is, yes, in that moment of the difficult conversation, if you can take a pause and think, I need to convey to this person two things, right? I need to convey that I really care, and I need to convey that I know what I'm talking about. Because if they believe those two things, they're much more likely, even though it's difficult, to listen to me. If they think I only care about myself, they're not going to listen. They're going to shut down. And if they think that whatever I'm telling them is wrong, they're also going to shut down. So how do I convey that I'm right and that I care? And I think about this a lot with my like kids is another example. Like, right? If they're not going to listen to you, if they don't think those two things are true, they have to believe you have their best interests at heart. And they have to believe that you actually know something, that you're right. So I would think about how do I convey those two things in this conversation? Okay, so that's the first. The second thing is, relationships, like if you're going to have a difficult conversation, it's probably not somebody you're only going to talk to this one time. That relationship had a past before we got to this point, and that relationship is simply going to have a future after this conversation. And it's important that you use all of the past, the present, the future to set yourself up for success. So the present I just talked about, which is what can I say in this moment that conveys to you that I care and I know what I'm talking about. But I also help people think about the past. I always tell people like, you don't exactly know what difficult conversation you're going to have and with whom, but you know they're going to come up. You're going to have a conflict. You're going to need to drive results. So what I tell people is from the second you come into someone's life, you should be thinking about all the easy ways you can build your respect with them. Because if the difficult conversation does arise, wouldn't you like it to be from a place where that person already says, I really respect you? Mm-hmm. It's going to make the whole thing a lot easier. So we should have been using our past with everybody to set ourselves up for success in this moment. And then we also have a future. Sometimes you might say, hey, I messed up. I went in and I was way too harsh or I was way too soft, whatever it is. We're not perfect. No. And then I would say, okay, let's say you had to give somebody some really critical feedback and it was going to hurt. And you're going to say you didn't do a good job. And they're going to, in that moment, feel like you don't really care about them. And they're going to be disappointed. Well, what's the future? What can you do tomorrow to help authentically show them that you do care? You know, could you be genuinely complimentary about something they're doing? Could you create an opportunity for them? Could you, you know, compliment them to somebody else, something like this? So that's how I think about these relationships is they're more than just the moment in time. Yes, you can do a better or worse job in that moment, but don't over-focus on the moment and forget about all these other signals that you send in that relationship over its lifetime. And so, yes, if you leaned in, even if it was just like you were really hangry, so you just were nasty and you weren't very warm in that whole thing. Well, what's tomorrow bring? Okay, I need to really lean into my warmth right now and show them how much I care because that's the part where I've taken a little bit of a hit that's in doubt.
No, that makes so much sense. And you're so right. We get really focused on that one moment in time, and there's what happens after, how you rebound, recover essentially from, it's going to happen. You're going to have those tough conversations with team members, your kids, your spouse, you know, whoever it is, but how you kind of continue to move on is really the next important part. So you mentioned you have kids. I have two teen daughters. So a lot of times I'm having these conversations, I'm thinking how I can help influence, impact, support them, you know, as they grow. So sometimes they roll their eyes with the things I talk about or the questions I'll ask them about leadership. But, you know, around this topic with your kids, what are you trying to instill in them today that they, you know, as they grow up, will be able to lean into?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, I think one of the things I try to do that is an outgrowth of my job as a psychologist is to help them think about their audience. And a lot of times we give kids messages early in life that they should become less concerned about their audience. We don't want them to experience peer pressure. We don't want them to hurt when someone says something unkind. And so we kind of tell them in a helpful way or a good, a well-intentioned way, hey, don't pay attention to that. Like, focus on yourself. But in reality, that's not the full entirety of the message, right? Because a lot of our success depends on being able to influence your audience. Like telling my kids, hey, you know what? You probably shouldn't wait until you have a bad grade on a test to ever talk to that teacher. Because like, why wouldn't you be building a relationship with that teacher all along the way? They're like, but I don't need any help. I'm like, that's not the point. No. The point is that's another human being. You want that human being to know how much you care and to see how capable you are. So that if something ever goes wrong, you already have that past. Why wouldn't you invest in that? So those kinds of ideas of helping them think about paying attention to their audience without chasing the validation of that audience. And I think that's something that we can start to have a more nuanced conversation with our kids about and with anybody that we mentor, whether they're biologically related to us or not, sure. Of this idea of, wait a second, like think about how that other person sees the world and how do you want them to see you? And then how can you show up in a way that gets them to see you that way? Like, let's start working backward from the point of view of our audience. And I think with kids in particular, we often give them the opposite message. Not because we don't understand it's important, but we're focused on a bunch of other things like the pressure, like the bullying, like the right. unkindness that they get. And then we tell them, like, ignore the world. And that's you need to ignore some things,
sure.
But you also need to invest in the right kinds of relationships in the right way.
Yeah. And I don't think you're ever too young to start talking about relationships and communication. I mean, I think it's something that a lot of adults struggle with, right? So it's if you can have those conversations and give them the tools and, hey, this is how this happens. And yeah, guess what? Not everyone's going to like you. That's okay. Like, but this is how you move on and you focus on your strengths and surround yourself with good people. And that's, you know, all we can control essentially. But that's exactly. Great. That's great advice. Well, this is awesome. So if people want to find Likeable Badass, more information about you, where can they connect with you?
The best place for people always to start for me is my website, which is my name. So that makes it pretty easy to find. And on my website, I have a bunch of stuff. There's information about me, like all kinds of fun facts, bio stuff. There's information about the book. There's all the media I've ever done. So podcasts, articles, etc. You could spend a lot of time there. And then there are easy ways to find me in these other places where I show up. So I do show up on social media, LinkedIn and Instagram in particular. And I also show up, I have a newsletter called The Upper Hand, which is behavioral science to help women excel. And all of those can be found as a one-stop shop through the website.
Perfect. Awesome. And we'll link that in the show notes for sure. I'm sure there's a lot of great information and can't wait to see what you do next. Do you have plans for after Likeable Badass or you're all in right now on Likeable Badass?
I do a lot of speaking and educating for women. And it's not always just about the things that are within the book, but that still does keep me very busy. 2025 was a year of just like existing with this new book in the world and bringing it to people. I have done that. And then in 2026, I'm going to think about like, where would I like to go next, which might involve another book. Maybe it won't. There's no secret there, but it's a 2026 TBD.
Awesome. Well, that's exciting. Well, best of luck. And I love the book and congratulations to you for all your success. And thank you for helping women be likable badasses. That's awesome.
Oh my gosh. Great to talk with you.
If you've ever been told you're too much of something, here's the reframe I'm taking with me.
Allison made it clear that the answer usually isn't to shrink, it's to add. When you feel like you have to hide parts of yourself, that's emotional labor, and it leads to burnout and resentment. Adding the right signal is not only more effective, it feels more authentic. Thanks for listening to Loud and Lifted. If this episode hit, share it with a woman who needs the reminder that she doesn't have to choose between being respected and liked. And don't forget to pick up Allison's book, Likeable Badass. Until next time, stay loud and stay lifted.